Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Before we get started today, I'd like to express my condolences for the passing of Bud Hatfield, as we know in franchising, the founder of Quick Copy and certainly a franchise pioneer. My heart goes out to his friends and family, as well as all the franchisees within the Quick Copy and ICED family of franchisees. Well, today begins our second annual Franchise Legal Series. And as you may recall, last year, Franchise Today co-producer Joe Caruso and I developed the first legal series, which was four parts. Now, this year, due to popular demand with respect to topics and guests, the series has been expanded to seven segments. That means the series will run starting today and every Thursday for the next 7 weeks, and will wrap up right before the Memorial Day weekend. And here's the rundown. Today is April 14th. I'll have Lane Fisher on the show. We'll be talking about earnings claims and financial performance representations, or as we know, FPRs. On April 21st, next Thursday, Jonathan Redgrave will be my guest as we talk about social media and e-discovery legal issues. The following week, Lee Plave will be on and we'll talk about franchise contemporary social media issues from a legal perspective. On May 5th, Warren Lee Lewis, the author of the Franchise Seller's Handbook, will be on to discuss, of course, franchise sales best practices. The following week, Leslie Curran will be on, and we'll talk about franchise broker issues in a digital world. The following week, May 19th, Adel Siegelheim will be my guest as we discuss the IFA Legal Symposium recap. And then we'll end the series on May 26th with Michael Webster about independent franchisee associations and why franchisors should love them. But before we get to today's segment, I'd like to extend my appreciation and kudos to the IFA for hosting the recent Small Business Lending Summit in Washington, D.C. That was last Thursday. It was certainly riveting, to say the least, and looked like a who's who of franchise professionals and franchise finance professionals, as well as some very prominent people from the banking world. In conjunction with the IFA, we will be presenting here on Franchise Today a 45 to 50 minute condensed audio from the event, and our hope is that through production it's done in time for our second annual Franchise Finance Series, which is scheduled for June. I'd also like to take a moment to remind all within the franchise community to watch CBS Undercover Boss this Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, when Shelley and J.D. Sun, co-founders of Bright Star Care, are featured on the show. It really seems like Undercover Boss continues to shine a light, a very good light on franchising, with 7-Eleven being featured on it right before the IFA convention, as well as Baja Fresh last week, and now, of course, Bright Star. And congratulations to Shelley, J.D., and the whole Bright Star family. And remember, that's Undercover Boss this Sunday on CBS. Now, for the premier segment of the second annual Franchise Legal Series on Franchise Today, I have to thank Joe Caruso once again for his assistance in co-producing Franchise Today and our legal series. You know, it's funny how a simple conversation evolves into thoughts and ideas and propels itself to a concept and then something much bigger. And that's exactly what's happened in a series of conversations with Joe that started 2 years ago that formed the foundation of the Franchise Legal Series last year, and we've evolved to this year. From there, we developed topics we felt were of interest to franchise professionals across various industry segments, and more importantly, wanted to be certain that the topics were relevant in franchising today. And today's topic, as do all seven topics in this series, fit the bill to a T. And franchise performance representations, or as I said earlier, as we know, are FPRs, are something that this week's guest, Lane Fisher, knows quite well. And as you may recall, Lane was one of our featured guests in our first legal series in 2010. Lane's a partner at Fisher Zucker LLC, and of course is a very active member within the IFA community. He's a frequent speaker at franchise conferences, has written extensively on franchise-related issues, and has appeared on several TV news shows. And for over 18 years, Lane has represented franchisors in business transactions and complex litigation, including matters related to trademark and copyright infringement, franchise development, and regulatory issues. He's also litigated the enforcement of franchise agreement obligations on behalf of franchisors, including non-competition covenants, collections, underreporting, and encroachment claims. Lane, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you know, before we get into our main topic today, Lane, you, Franchise Today co-producer Joe Caruso, and I just last week attended the IFA Small Business Lending Summit with what we like to say 200 of our closest franchise and banker executive friends. And it seems clear that the franchise lending environment will remain extremely challenging for quite some time. And before we get into today's topic, if you would, you know, what were some of your thoughts about the Small Business Lending Summit?
Well, I actually enjoyed it as well and got to meet a lot of new folks. I think that what was clear to me from the comments and the speakers at the summit is that the demand for franchise business growth in 2011 will far outpace the availability of those businesses to obtain financing, despite a improving business climate. The challenge, as identified by IFA CEO and President Steve Caldera, is to communicate the promise of lower risk using a franchise business model and obviously demonstrating the higher liquidity of franchise loans to the lending community. I thought that IFA did an amazing job assembling all of the constituencies and focusing efforts on the credit markets. IFA partnered with the National Restaurant Association and four other lender trade associations to pool resources to tackle the problem and to identify best practices and hopefully communicate information about new lending programs. I think that two useful byproducts of the event is that IFA formed a working group, which is smaller obviously than the 200 who attended, to work on this issue more or less full-time as their only directive. And they are wanting to create a national franchise loan registry to help standardize and streamline the loan process for participating franchisors, franchisees, and lenders, much like the franchise registry. So all in all, I thought IFA did a great job of bringing all the folks together, sharing information that we as a trade association have collected at great cost, and allowing the lenders to identify their issues and to give us an opportunity to try to overcome some of them. So I thought it was a great event, and I think it will be effective in its byproducts in trying to loosen up credit.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And for the people that were not at the event, and I'd like to say that, you know, it wasn't always during the event a lot of peaches and cream and roses being thrown around. I mean, there were some almost heated moments where there was some disagreement, and I think it's those type of things that really brought about the legitimacy of the whole thing, as well as the thought process behind really wanting to work out. I was very impressed that it wasn't just a series of presentations. There was a lot of open discussion. There were disagreements. There was even a little bit of finger-pointing, and I think if all of that wasn't there, I would have walked away feeling that maybe it really wasn't real and it was a bunch of show-and-tell, and I certainly didn't walk away feeling that way. I really felt that there was some very sincere, genuine concern and willingness to work our way out of a very uncomfortable situation. And, of course, in this era of the new normal brought about, of course, by the recession and the economic circumstances and, of course, the franchise lending crisis, how vital is it, Lane, for a franchisor to have a FPR, a franchise, a financial performance representation?
Well, Paul, we think it's critical. I mean, I think that in order to demonstrate essentially your business's performance coming out of a recession, the only way you can legally do it is through a financial performance representation. And companies who don't do it lose this, a great opportunity to try to differentiate and profile their underlying business. According to Fran data, and I guess the numbers are improving, that 40% of all franchisors make financial performance representations unless you're in a franchise broker network, and then the number goes up to a staggering 70%. And I think that's because when you're in a group where you're selling against specific competitors, each of whom have earnings claims, it's almost impossible to fairly compete with them without one of your own. And so, you know, we see that the rising tide to include them is continuing to rise. We see still fewer of them with newer or inception-based franchisors, but more mature franchisors that have lots of data are certainly incorporate or moving to disclosing some data, and some of them are going beyond disclosing, you know, lots of information.
You know, personally, I believe it's imperative that franchisors make financial performance representations. And, of course, I know that there are some franchisors that have a general reluctance in making these type of representations, and it seems like the trend is starting to change a little bit more, as you said, with more franchisors including an item 19 in their franchise disclosure document. But what do you say to the franchisors who are afraid to have an FPR in their FDD?
Well, you know, most often you have to drill down and figure out what the genesis of the objection is and where they heard, you know, what they know, where they know it from, and what advice they've been given in the past. Frankly, some folks who are still devoutly against it are just behind the times, and they're operating on an outdated interpretation of the rules. I would say that the FPRs have been used and been valued for their help in franchise development. But when you think about and if you listen to lenders and folks who work with lenders talk, the lenders, franchise disclosure document is the single most relevant piece of information that a lender considers in evaluating a loan package. In most cases, it's the only piece of information for non-public franchisors. So many folks have said for years now that if you're not essentially trying to demonstrate to a bank why your business is worthwhile and bankable, then you're missing a great opportunity to improve your offering. And so I think that folks, especially nowadays when the lenders are the ones scrutinizing the FDD and any financial performance representation, that it's even more critical that you have it. I think many folks sort of stumble into what their competitors are doing and realize that they're at an extreme competitive disadvantage if they can't respond in kind to not necessarily identical measures to try to make an apples and apples comparison, but at least some measure, a productive measure of what makes your business a worthwhile investment, whether it be by economies in costs or in super gross sales or whatever it is that you might have that you've used to distinguish yourself from your competition, but also which distinguish your business model and hopefully its profitability.
You know, and as I said, you know, we are in what appears to be the new normal, and we do have a large portion of our audience are relatively new franchisors and a lot of emerging brands. So kind of as a backdrop, if you would, to this today's discussion on FPRs, if you would, Lane, give us a little bit of historical insight on the evolution of franchise regulation, kind of just bring us up to where we are today.
Okay, sure. In 1971, California was the first state to regulate the sale of franchises, and many other states followed suit, and each state, as they enacted a state law, had different requirements for complying with it, and it became very, very difficult for franchisors to navigate what was an ever-changing regulatory landscape for franchise sales. And ultimately, in 1979, Congress moved forward and enacted the FTC rule, which is the Federal Rule Governing Franchising, in an attempt to standardize how franchises are sold nationally. Now, the FTC rule always permitted states who wanted to have more onerous regulations to continue to have them, but it did standardize a central form of way to comply with the franchise sales laws generally. In 1995, the rules were relaxed further. People always operate or often operate on the misconception that regulators don't like earnings claims and they don't like people who make them, when in fact regulators have tried to make them mandatory for the last 20 years and think they are the single most important piece of information. So they, in response to not being able to make them mandatory, have taken steps over the years, including recently, to make them easier to make and to have franchisors to park certain fears of franchisors about making them and to try to deal with certain points that were raised in the hearing process about why franchisors didn't make them. And in 2007, and as the FTC rule was amended, they continued to take out requirements that, including the geographic relevant requirements, and they permitted you to disclose subsets of information, which all along you had to disclose all of your information, again, in a way to try to motivate franchisors to make these kind of claims. So that's sort of the history as we come up to now. So now they're totally permitted. In fact, under the new rule, under the old rule, there was this dance that people did about that they weren't allowed to make claims, and then some folks colored that to, under federal law, I'm not allowed to make claims. And what they meant was they weren't allowed to do it outside of the FDD, but that was often misinterpreted by the prospect. And now in item 19 of the new rule, if you don't make an earnings claim, you're required to disclose that you're allowed to and that you're choosing not to. And in a way that puts folks on notice that, you have the data, you're choosing not to disclose it. So that's sort of a brief history of regulation. And again, I think the law has changed, just to make one more point, is because more and more there are more people involved in the franchise sales process, other than just you, if you're the person selling it in terms of a startup franchisor, because many folks use discovery days and a lot of folks use brokers. And to the extent that you invite third parties to participate in the franchise sales process, then defining what they're allowed to say and giving them, frankly, a script to speak from, rather than a list of prohibitions about what they're not to say, protects the franchisor and prevents, frankly, a franchisee, they may argue it, but hopefully not prevailing on a claim that that they didn't know about it. So, but that's, that's why I think it's become more and more, because it's recognizing all these other folks participate in the process and, wanting to negate a franchisee's ability to argue that they relied on the napkin, if you will, or in the oral claim when there's a writing in the FDD that applies specifically on point to the matter you're talking about.
Sure, and as I preach with franchisors when they want to start in the world of franchising, or when they start their franchise development efforts, or even when they start their social media or marketing efforts, development of a strategy is certainly essential. And I know the same thing is true in developing an FPR strategy. It's getting down to the nitty-gritty, like you said, at some point having a script, if you would, for what people should or shouldn't say, as well as, of course, as you referred to, the necessary data. And so I guess my question, going back to the startups, would be, what about the franchisors who say, hey, I just started, I don't have enough data to create an FPR, or, we only have one, company unit, so we could never have an FPR. What do you say to those folks?
I mean, the answer is, I think that you still try to scrutinize those kinds of offerings to find out and to figure out what kind of information you can give. My partners always say, find the data, either use the data that you have. So if you have a one-unit operation and you choose to disclose information about the one unit, I mean, so you certainly have a basis to do that in your FPR. Now, I would care if the unit is in Times Square or the unit is, at the foot of a ginormous office building, I might footnote and disclose that. I might actually go overboard in over-disclosing any location-specific or, for example, if it had operated for a really long period of time. But all the material assumptions, I might actually go even more overboard on that. But I think that and I've read the regulator and examiner comments, and they want you to give the reliable information that you have. So I would scrub the information for what you could present. If the information, frankly, if we never didn't operate long enough to even present a year's worth of data, you might look at things like alternative measures, some of the stuff I know we're going to talk about later, to try to describe and disclose that earning potential.
Certainly I couldn't imagine being a franchisor and having run a couple of national franchise organizations of being able to compete in today's market without a financial performance representation. And, of course, there are a lot of misconceptions about FPRs that I'd have to say, both franchisors and some attorneys actually have. What have you heard with respect to what some of these common misconceptions are?
Well, I've heard people say that it has to be based on audited data, that you have to have, you know, operated the units themselves, that they can or can't present franchisor or franchisee data, that they have to show a bunch of information about units of size, shapes, and proportions that they no longer offer. They clearly don't understand the purpose of the rule and what you're trying to ultimately end up with as the unit you're describing, and frankly, as the one that is the one that you're trying to sell and not one that is completely that is in a site that would never get approved today or something like that. So, but we get lots of information like that they don't, you know, that you haven't verified it independently or had accountants verify it, you know, and that's unreliable and that somehow you'll be exposed to claims of prospects for providing this historical data when the rule provides precisely the opposite. Now, you obviously have to stick to the harbor, if you will, with respect to reporting historical data and documenting your material assumptions. But you know, other than that, I think you're good.
Yeah, so basically now we have some franchisors that are out there that are convinced that having an FPR is both a competitive and protective advantage. How would they go about establishing that reasonable basis for their item 19 FPR?
Well, first you want to try to look at what you're presenting, obviously, and its relevance to what you're currently offering. And it may be appropriate to segregate units into shapes and sizes, common footprints or types of units in order to have a reasonable basis and not be misleading. I mean, I've always said that to the extent you profile businesses that are not of the type you're offering, you're actually creating almost a misleading kind of FPR because you're congesting the relevant data with data that is arguably irrelevant. And so you're always trying to drill down to Cousin Subs used to call it the highly efficient unit, but I suspect that was their most current iteration of what their offer was. But that's really what you're trying to profile and not necessarily a whole hodgepodge of all sorts of operating results that maybe have been relevant to prior offers. Again, I think that you know, that's we'd have a reasonable basis to the extent that the business you were profiling was like and of a character of what you were licensing to franchisees, and that's what you're required to have. And obviously, if there's stuff that makes it different or any points of differentiation, like a bigger territory or like some other market, then you'd be required to disclose that as well.
Sure, and a lot of our listeners are looking for that silver bullet just like they do in social media and marketing and franchise sales. They look for that same silver bullet with respect to FPRs, especially, and as you just mentioned a few moments ago about the non-traditional FPRs, and I've had the pleasure of hearing you speak professionally about them as well. You know, I know that what you've mentioned in the past are, you know, you could use closing rates, average sales tickets, et cetera. If you would, can we just discuss maybe a couple of examples of different business channels, maybe where a non-traditional FPR is practical, and if you would explain a little bit in detail about your theory of non-traditional FPRs.
Okay, sure. I mean, I've always believed that they were relevant to all businesses. So, I mean, and I think it's just a matter of being creative in terms of how you go to set them up. Obviously, in mobile businesses or businesses which are sales-based, any kind of way that you can demonstrate, like, for example, the achievable volume either per technician or per van or per sales guy or per neighborhood or per sales stop, I think is show your business in a favorable light. My favorite in this one is closing rate. So if I knew that 8 out of 10 people that I called on would ultimately enter into a contract and that the average contract was X, I could work with that and I might be able to visualize myself in the business making 8 calls to get 6 or 10 calls to get 8. So I think that those are not promises of any kind of multi-million dollar return, but rather expressions of the productivity of the business that, frankly, you should be analyzing anyway and benchmarking to try to identify best practices within your own organization. Sometimes we profile national accounts productivity as distinguished from franchise gross sales. In the hotel business, you could do, you know, vacancy and occupancy rates. You might do productivity of other of the coupon discount or customer loyalty type programs if you can garner any metrics from that. You might demonstrate the yield from a particular amount of product or service in terms of its gross sales potential. You might demonstrate, in a restaurant, for example, the productivity of a particular promotional vehicle or the effectiveness. If you think your point of differentiation is catering and that you do catering better than anybody else and it's a better margins, to demonstrate that, you know, that you can do an extra $100,000 in gross sales in catering and a catering director costs, you know, some fraction of that, and you can probably justify the cost of doing it. When you're trying to roll out a new service that's not quite mandatory, but you'd like people to invest the resources in, demonstrating the economic productivity of that particular service in markets where it's been in use is, you know, are all reasonable ways to capture favorable metrics about your business that you're, that hopefully will be meaningful to your prospects. And again, you're debriefing your own salespeople about what prospects are asking is always a good starting point, because you like to give people a script for the information they actually want to present. But we have found these, and this is where we're spending most of our time these days, Paul, on trying to figure out what these metrics are in terms of identifying them, how we fare in terms of analyzing them, and what our you know, what our averages are, what our deviation from the averages are, and then how to present them in a way that, that makes it easy for the sales folks and other folks that will be obviously talking folks through them. But even if you talked about, I don't mean to go on and on, but like rebookings, referral businesses from existing clients, like if somebody signs on to a contract, let's say for a gym, and their average term was 18 months at some $100 a month or whatever it is, as opposed to it being month to month as it would say on the contract, those would be great metrics that I might use. Some of the big gyms talk about number of members to get to either break even or other things. Those are great metrics, and they're unique to each industry. So I've heard some education franchises talk about number of students or student-to-teacher ratio or, you know, all of those things, which, and I don't know what particular company we're talking about, but obviously they fit into their own market and hopefully have, you know, some basis in terms of comparison. Again, even if you were, if I went in and I said the average drain cleaning was $100, but on average people spend $150 because they bought either some upsold service or product that we sell in additionally and along with the service, I think all of those things go a long way in profiling your business in a way for prospects and now for lenders, without a promise of becoming a millionaire. So, you know, that's what we like. Well, that's what we've been spending a lot of time talking about.
Sure, and it's it kind of follows along the line of what I speak about a lot, which is it's don't try to make it a one size fits all type of strategy, and what you're saying makes a lot of business sense, but it also makes a lot of practical sense, and probably would force franchisors to look more at their internal operations, which they should be doing so anyway, but we know too often than not that they don't, and this is probably a good exercise, and really is not just a legal framework, although that's what's required within the FDD, but, you know, just a good practical business framework in order to come up with these things. And, you know, sometimes people interrupt, you know, creative or speculative or unsubstantiated. And we really need to make the distinction for the audience that it's not the proverbial creative accounting. I mean, the claim still must have a reasonable basis, and I know you would agree completely with that.
Well, I do, and it's not a cook the books kind of let's show somebody, you know, a snapshot that's not relevant, and I'm not at all an advocate for the fast and loose approach to this. But I think when all the data is collected and assembled, we usually see it in the form of a spreadsheet. You know, you can see, you can look at the averages and you can see the outliers. And you ask a question about, well, why is this one's gross sales so low and it's only operated 2 hours a day? You know, well, that's, I would strike out ones that, I'm only going to profile ones that are full-time, because I don't today license people to do part-time businesses. So that would be irrelevant. But so each cut you make on the data has to be consistent with, like, your business objectives and with the offer you're ultimately making. But you're trying to, you know, so a lot of folks would have trouble merging gross sales of units open 1 month versus ones open a year. And the one-month ones, if you tried to average them, would bring the average down really low. So most folks typically don't profile ones that aren't open a year, unless none of them are open a year, and then they might profile them and try to demonstrate an improving level of sales, month-to-month gross sales, to try to demonstrate at least that sales are rising, because they want to be able to use that in the sales process. But normalization and, you know, cooking the books are two different things. Normalization is a very careful process. Each time you make a strikeout criteria, you document it and you make sure that you apply it uniformly, so you're not just inventing rules to strike out one but not another that meets the same selection criteria. So it takes a little bit of effort to go through and figure out, you know, whether it's a part-time person. In other cases, we've seen them where one was a second unit that was, you know, just getting started and was borrowing a lot of the labor and a lot of the inventory off of from the first unit. So both measures that we were trying to add were not accurate for in terms of what we were doing. You also have circumstances where certain old franchisees, perhaps, or people with the original forms of agreement don't have to give you any data or give you data on some point, basis which you don't think is reliable. So you're really always trying to only present the reliable data. And in most cases, the franchisor knows what they're doing, really knows what they expect the answer to be, because they are fishing for a number that they should already have a close expectation about what the labor percentage is or the occupancy cost is when they go out to collect the information from franchisees. So yeah, normalization,
sure,
very deliberate process, and it's one that, look, if a franchisee asks to see the backup, you have to give it to them. So you want to make sure that it's well organized, that you're not, you know, it's not individual slips of paper which are all in some giant pile somewhere, but rather somebody could walk you through what you did to take the full universe, because that's usually what we start with, the full universe, down to the universe that was presented, and just to verify that that the strikeout criteria was applied uniformly. But keeping that backup is important, and having a consistent methodology and applying it consistently is important.
Right, and certainly just to emphasize once again, cooking the books and doing the math type of philosophy is certainly not prudent and certainly can get people in trouble. And, you know, I know last year, looking back in preparation for today's show, looking at the transcript of our discussion last year, we talked briefly about, you know, some people out there playing fast and loose and seeming to thumb their noses at, you know, following the rules and probably spending way too much time on the far end of creativity to the point of, as you said, cooking the books. And, you know, I think there's just still too many people out there that don't understand that there is risk in providing improper FPRs and consequences as well. And I know we didn't prepare for this in preparation for today's show, but just briefly, I mean, can you explain what potentially some of those consequences could be?
I mean, look, if you don't follow the rules for earnings claims, you could very well be found to be making some kind of projection, and a projection of what a franchisee will do in his or her respective location is something measurable against what they actually do. And so if you say somebody will do 200 and they do 100, you could be liable to them for the difference. So you really want to make sure that at least we try to avoid projection-based earnings claims or any way for our non-projection-based earnings claims to get converted into one. I think that there's no private right of action under the FTC rule, but certainly all the states that have little FTC acts and most of the registration states have remedies and private rights of action for improper earnings claims, let's say. And those can have pretty substantial penalties with respect to it. Not to mention people can go to the FTC and file claims and complaints and get an investigation initiated. And, of course, the FTC and the states have pretty steep fines, penalties, and other remedies in their statutes for folks who breach it. And, in fact, I think Illinois' statute has a criminal element to it. So, I mean, it's not good, and it's not good to play fast and loose. And, frankly, it seems to me that if you're giving inaccurate information as folks go around and try to verify that with your various franchisees, if you have any, you know, they'll certainly immediately find bigger deviations from what you're presenting, which would take away, obviously, from your credibility. And also, you know, there's officer and director liability under most of the statutes for folks who, you know, make these kind of improper earnings thing. So it's a big deal. And it's not that hard to do it right, Paul. That's what you and I always sort of laugh about, that people will spend much more time, energy, and expense in trying to do something they can't do rather than just trying to follow a methodology and be creative in terms of what you present.
Sure, and I love the practical side of it, of really getting franchisors to focus on their business and use that creativity to be able to present a proper FPR. And along those lines, I've heard you mention in the past the use of surveys in FPRs, and that sounds like a very novel approach. What type of concepts would it be appropriate, and what type of situation would be appropriate to employ a survey in an FPR?
Well, I mean, you could probably use it to fill in any missing piece of data. By way of example, in a restaurant franchising system, usually occupancy cost is well known and easily documented and verified. And food costs are well known and easily documented. But labor costs, sometimes people have varying ways to account for labor. So in a lot of cases, what people might report to you for labor might be have a wide deviation in terms of what they're presenting. And so we have often gone back to the system with respect to, let's say, labor, and tried to pull that very specifically, defining the labor that we were trying to capture, and most often soliciting results that we were otherwise expecting and that would have been consistent with how most of the folks did it. So we have, and many times, you know, you want to make sure that you get a reasonable response. It has to be statistically relevant, and franchisors sometimes have to get on the phone and get some folks to return the surveys, and sometimes they give them something free for doing so. But you need to have a reasonable number and a reasonable response rate. But, I mean, I remember seeing disclosures 3 or 4 years ago where the response rate was in the 50% range, and because it represented 50% of the franchisees was a higher percentage of the number of units, it looked to me to be statistically relevant. And there were a couple hundred units, so you were still looking at a fair number of items. But people have used it for all kinds of things in terms of, you know, a coupon that just ran or a national ad campaign or, you know, trying to field information back.
You know, as you were talking and you were giving some specifics with respect to various industry segments, I think the thing that I would like to recommend to our listeners that, you know, as you are working with a franchise attorney, make sure they have an understanding of your business, because all the things you were pointing out, if they didn't have an understanding of business and just had the understanding of the rules, certainly there would be some lacking or creativity might be lacking just because of not having an understanding of your business. And I would also recommend that you educate your franchise attorneys into all the different aspects of your business so that they can help you prepare a more creative but in line FPR. You know,
Paul,
let me
just jump in for a second. Maybe the place to start, frankly, is on the benchmarking side, because it's much better to call somebody about wanting to benchmark your results against other system franchisees and to get it more of a competition than I want to take your results and manufacture it into my sales document. And frankly, you don't even, part of the task in identifying what you'd want to present is really what you're best at, and that SWOT analysis often includes obtaining and collecting some benchmarking data. And so before you, in terms of analyzing and be able to show what you're good at, you need to know what you're going to look at and how you're going to measure it. And so, and people benchmark everything from sales productivity, but to customer satisfaction and other things that are very good information to portray. And then moving from the benchmarking side, that's when you can sort of see whether people are reporting data in a consistent manner. And then you would probably go to decide whether that information is useful to the sales process and incorporate it into your earnings claim. But that's the methodology we try to walk people through, because it always starts with, like, what? Why you? You know, assuming a prospect sat you down and said, why you? You need to know what makes your business one that is worth franchising and that people would want to have access to your business system. And that, to me, starts at benchmarking, and then the additional fruit of that very participative process is the earnings claim.
Yeah, absolutely. A good point. I'm glad you made it with respect to benchmarking. And, you know, to put a fine point on this. You know, it does take a lot of work. It takes a lot of thought in order to do this correctly. And I guess a word of warning to startup franchisors is ignorance is no excuse, and certainly the penalty is great for improper FPR. So definitely heed this advice. You know, some of the most compelling franchise recruitment advertising in print media and online that I've seen the last couple of years have been FPR claims and ads. How should a franchisor use an FPR in a print or online medium, and what are basically the required disclaimer rules?
Got you. So the general rule is that you have to give somebody an FDD in conjunction and at the same time as you give them and make them an earnings claim. So you want to make sure that you comply with what we call the general media exemption with respect to making claims in the general media. Now, first, you need to have an item 19, right? You can't just make any claims in your advertising if you don't have an item 19. And you need to register the advertising in states which have advertising registration requirements. And you have to separate corporate and franchisee data and state the number of units in the subset that met or exceed the average number that you are disclosing. And you have to include certain cautionary language, including, you know, if you rely on the figures, you have to accept the risk of not doing as well in order to comply with the exemption. But assuming that you otherwise comply, Paul, you and I agree that that is some of the most powerful advertising that you can create. And if you look in the back of the Wall Street Journal and others, you'll see that many franchisors, more and more, lead off with some metric out of their FPR. And in most cases, it might be average unit volume or same quarter sales increases, you know, back to back for X months or whatever it is that you might that might create a very compelling picture, especially when the folks that you're looking for might be experienced restaurant or business operators whose attention you're trying to capture with only the you know, the power of your ad. So by putting your best metric and your best foot forward, you're casting a wider line for folks that would whose interest would be piqued based on those metrics as opposed to on some underlying love for your product or service. Does that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. You know, going back to what you said, and I was thinking about this because you said that a prospective franchisee can ask for the detail or basis on an item 19 FPR. Do you think most franchisors are prepared to comply with that requirement? Do they? I know they have to have the backup. Do you think they have it in an organized fashion?
I mean, I can't speak to ones that I've not seen. Certainly our folks, we organize it in a way that you always say, you know, what if the person who we work with isn't there? You want to be able to pull
right.
a file in the drawer and then be able to determine what, you know, what happened. So I know that we give our people because we're well aware of that request. Now, we don't have that many people request it prior to sale and not in connection with, you know, litigation or some other question. But, you know, you need to have your substantiating documentation and we could certainly need to produce it. That's probably where it comes up next in the course of any ongoing dispute with a franchisee. So I don't know if other folks keep it. They certainly should. It would be difficult and time-consuming. And I'm not sure that reliable to try to do a scramble to figure out what happened, you know, finding very little in file with respect to preparing them. So the substantiating documentation and the byproduct of something that's reasonable that you'd be proud to share with the fact finder and or franchisee's lawyer is critical to following the best practice, if you will.
Yeah, and I think the I like the term you use, proud to share. And I think that's what it should be, and that document and the backup should be living live beyond the people that put it together because everybody might be going their separate ways down the road, but that document has to live on as well as the documentation. You know, in addition to attending the recent lending summit, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, we bumped at you at the IFE Expo in Washington, D.C., you know, and I received an interesting FPR report while I was there. A franchisor with what looked like a bona fide compliant item 19 with disclaimer language was showing a prospect the information, which sounded, you know, harmless enough until the franchise executive added verbally that while the chart shows data from the prior year, the company's three most recent openings are tracking north of, you know, and he said X dollars. And in this type of particular situation, and I know you weren't there to hear the circumstances, and I certainly don't want to convey, you know, who the person was with the concept, but in that type of scenario, do you believe that franchise executive's verbal representation, in addition to the item 19, was or was not compliant?
I mean, I would caution our folks not to make statements like that. I think it's not compliant because it's outside the bounds of the four walls of the published FPR in your document. Obviously, that's limited in terms of time, scope, and whatever else it says. And again, when you start to make to get information into the newer year without all the other information that would come along with your FPR to make it compliant, you create this potential for bad information. We're very careful to caution our people to talk about what it says and not what it doesn't say. And the whole purpose of this exercise is to identify not a script, but at least discussion points of things that you're allowed to say. And so it would trouble me that somebody would then be coloring it into a more recent perspective. Now, if the first quarter results, Paul, were so outstanding and so completely better in multiples of what we'd otherwise presented, I would probably counsel that franchisor to amend and to try to get the new earnings claim information in there because it presents a much more compelling story, and then I would use that in my advertising and for all the other purposes that we were describing. But tracking north of, I don't know if X dollars is the same as what the gross sales were last year or if X is some different number, but I would certainly perhaps suggest that prospect contact some of our franchisees, and they can even, obviously, they can know the ones that were the most recent openings, and you can identify them for them, and they can have whatever discussion they want. But, you know, you never know what, initial demand sometimes burns off, and, you know, you don't know what special circumstances or if it was around the July 4th, celebration or some other reason why it was not representative. But we try to get people to stay within the information that we present and in terms of all their discussions about it, because we very much want people to stay in what we describe as a safe harbor with respect to historical results. Now, it may be true, and of course the truth is no defense because it's still outside of the scope of your item 19. Now, if it's true, you may have other issues with respect to damages and whatnot, but it's still outside of the scope, and a good lawyer will tell you you should stay within what you've published. And if there's something that is critical for you to say, then you should incorporate it into your FDD. That's why the process begins with benchmarking and discussing with folks in your sales process what information they would find relevant and would want to share with prospects.
And again, what you're saying is it makes total practical sense, and it probably also emphasizes the point that there really needs to be some training of franchise agents, franchise salespeople, with respect to the item 19 and in general what's in the FDD. And so for franchisors that are out there, please make sure you're doing so. You mentioned also that if there was some really significant improvement in, let's say, the first quarter numbers, you mentioned about amending the disclosure document and the item 19. Is an amendment the same or different as a supplemental FPR?
Well, no, an amendment would be different. Amendment would be to change the underlying results that you're presenting, and obviously this would have been to make it more recent. Supplemental earnings claims allow you to take the data on the same measurement period and measuring stick that you presented, let's say, last year and that's in your document, and present subsets of that data that went in to create the averages. So the most often place you might find it used is if you're trying to sell, let's say, units in the Southeast, and Southeast units perform better than your average system unit volume or average system profitability, people often ask for a supplemental earnings claim, which, again, it can be handed outside the document, on just the Southeast locations that otherwise met the entire selection, strikeout, and other criteria. Again, you're not presenting new data. You're just presenting subsets of existing data. And frankly, Paul, people use that tool far too little. In every venue that I'm at, every time I talk about it, if I ask people to raise their hand, people are afraid of it for some reason. We often prepare the supplemental claim and hand it to somebody so that there's not an issue about what they might be, because it's not really what you would choose to pull it at. It has to be in writing, right, left with the prospect, and reliable otherwise. So it's important that you know, you follow the criteria in doing it. But it's underutilized, and it should be used more.
Yeah, it definitely seems to. As much as I'm entrenched in franchising day in and day out, there's a little confusion in my mind regarding the using a supplemental FBR. And the way you described it, it definitely seems like it would be very strategic and certainly constructive to do so. So I'm glad you pointed that out, and I'm glad we started down that road with that question with the amendment. Because in my mind, I was kind of thinking along the same line. So thank you for clarifying that.
Hey, Paul, can I just jump in? Well, you mentioned something a minute ago about compliance training, and I think that it really needs to be driven home. I think that, you know, we see lots of folks in litigation-type contexts when the dispute has gone, you know, obviously beyond the resolvable, and you'd be surprised how many people in their depositions and otherwise in participating in a case would ultimately, you know, you want to know how they answer the question, what training have you been given in franchise sales compliance? And you're sort of, you of course, well, prep the witness ahead of time, but you hate when the answer is none, especially when there's some great resources out there to get up to speed. And people who think they know everything then don't even know what they don't even know, because it is complicated. And frankly, when you're using a particular earnings claim that you've developed for your own company, the training might be a little different than what you find in the public domain. But IFA's Educational Foundation has an amazing curriculum of information on franchise.org. There are web-based compliance programs. There are live programs that move around the country. There are some for which you get CFE credit, but you know, and that CFE is being another whole, you know, educational process for being the best you can be. And so we think that's really important. Folks should at least take advantage of the stuff that's low cost and easily available and at their disposal, like the training program online. Nobody should be saying that they were either too busy or too whatever to have at least taken the IFA's online program or attended any of these events that we've described, Paul, any of the programming that relates to franchise sales compliance, because it's abundant, relatively inexpensive, and worth its weight in gold in the event a dispute arises.
Sure, absolutely, and I'm fully in agreement with respect to compliance training and all types of training. I don't think there's enough people taking advantage of it to the extent that they should. So I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, there are some, I think there's a bunch of franchise salespeople out there that feel that the existence of an FPR means they could say anything since they have an affirmative FPR. And as you said, you know, it needs to be in line with what the FPR says, and there needs to be compliance training in order to fully understand, you know, what's in the document and how to present it. Because I know I hear too often than not, oh, I just can't sell under those circumstances, and it's more because they don't want to take the time to learn how to sell in those circumstances. And I think training is absolutely an important part.
Yeah, I mean, look, part of using the tools chest is knowing how to, you know, having some training and how to use it. And folks, that I agree with you, it's people think they know far too much.
and on top of it, you know, again, going back down to the practicality of the whole thing, it should make it easier to sell and make your efforts more effective. So, again, I think it comes down to, you know, people just being lazy or feel they know it all and can just wing it. And I think there's also the other side of it, which I think we could talk about for a whole nother hour, where they think, well, you know, the consequences aren't that bad, or when it finally comes to light, I'll be long gone. And like I said, I think that's another conversation for another day. You know, with respect to you know, financial performance representations. And as we know, it's a great idea. We both agree to have an item 19. What are the limitations of what the franchisor can say in addition to the claim or about the claim?
I don't know about limitations, since you're required to fully and carefully document all your material assumptions. I've not seen anybody say that you know, there's something you can't say. At some point, when you say something and then you spend the next four pages taking it away, it says very little. And examiners sometimes have problems in the way that you present data and will come in and try to mostly have you comply with the rule about disclosing how many met or exceeded it. But there are certain measures, and we've certainly had dialogue and looked back at claims to resolve examiner questions or make additional documentation concerning the examiner's comments. So, but I'm not aware of any particular limitation. I mean, I wouldn't go stick the kitchen sink in there. I always try to – I view the FDD in terms of how it's used in this process as, you know, carefully documenting the costs. And then the next place you'd go, I think, would be the item 19 to try to demonstrate the benefit if you were trying to do it like you sell anything else. So I wouldn't put the whole kitchen sink in there, and I would be reluctant. I've seen some people, like, they have these charts. They go on and on. They conclude nothing. They make no overall statements about it, but they just dump a whole lot of data on you. I think that's a huge mistake. I would never do that. I would – the object is – to synthesize it down to something usable where people are not making 97 different interpretations of what it means, but where you've taken a position on what it means and what it says. So, you know, I don't put the kitchen sink in there. I think you're trying to figure out what it is you need to say and then make yourself a platform to say it.
Sure, and what franchisors need to realize is that, you know, because as you were mentioning about the examiners, and I was thinking, you know, this is really a multi-purpose type of document. I mean, obviously, it needs to be accepted and by the examiners, but it also needs to be utilized as a sales tool. And I think that ultimately gets back to, you know, a lot of people don't want to use an item 19 because they think, well, you know, it's just it's just something that has to be in the document. I don't want to go through the work, and they don't realize how powerful a sales tool that it can be as well.
Well, and it's what's funny, Paul, is that some people haven't even reconciled that with their own sales process. So sometimes we enter in a circumstance where somebody's giving you the absolute unequivocal no. You determine that all their, you know, that an integral part of their sales process is to give the franchisee some spreadsheet onto which to make some projections, and then expect the franchisee to develop data. So I think that if your process is requiring folks to garner information, providing it to them, is or at least your historical information so they can develop their own projections, becomes incredibly important and sort of hard then to know what conversation would be accompanying the blank spreadsheet or what information might be conveyed with it. That might be outside of the earnings claim, as opposed to giving folks the tools they would need to develop their own estimates based on at least your historical data. And so, I mean, I think it's funny that way.
Yeah. Well, one quick question, because we are getting close to the top of the hour, and I know some franchisors had this question in mind. And as you know, the IFA, in conjunction with the MFV expositions next year, we'll have the International Franchise Expo in New York City at the Javits Center instead of in Washington, D.C. And the important franchisor question is that since New York is a registration state, does a franchisor exhibiting at that show need to be registered to sell in New York State?
In a word, yes, they need to register. New York law applies to offers and sales made in the state of New York as well as outside New York if the franchisor is located in New York. It's one of the broadest forms of state laws that there is, and it requires, you know, registration of advertising unless it's exempt. And it's exempt if 2/3 of the circulation is outside the state and not directed to anyone in the state. But there's no trade show exemption. So once your conversations become substantive, the law would suggest that you need to give somebody a FDD at the first person, you know, that at what would be the first personal meeting, which is when you're meeting with the prospect in the booth. So I think people are asking us that question as well, and I think that general discussions about, you know, why the drain cleaning business is good would not perhaps trigger those disclosures. But when you're going to start making earnings claims and having specific discussions about the underlying opportunity in my state, then it would trigger it.
Sure, absolutely.
Not unlike California, in that folks have to be registered in California to exhibit at the West Coast show.
Right.
Yeah, folks who want to exhibit there, you need to get on the stick a couple months earlier so that you can get registered and and exhibit. And I suspect that they'll give people that advice when they go to register.
Sure. Well, Lane, it has again been my pleasure and honor to have you as my guest on Franchise Today and as our first guest this year in the second annual Franchise Legal Series on Franchise Today. And I look forward to further discussions with you.
That's great. Thank you for having me.
Remember, segments of Franchise Today are available on demand shortly after the show, and along with archive segments may be accessed at blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. Next week, the Franchise Legal Series continues as my guest Jonathan Redgrave and I and e-discovery issues. And, of course, please don't forget to watch CBS Undercover Boss with Bright Star co-founders Shelley and J.D. Sun this Sunday night. Until then, I'm Paul Segretto, wishing you the best in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.